Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There are now two large movements of Americans underway. The thousands of soldiers being assigned to the Persian Gulf in preparation for an attack on Iraq, and the thousands of protesters assigning themselves the task of insisting that such an attack should not happen. And the pace for both is picking up. Next week, the weapons inspectors report to the UN, President Bush makes his State of the Union address, and meets with his comrade-in-arms Prime Minister Tony Blair. This against a backdrop of growing criticism at home and abroad from people determined to do what they can to prevent a war. This hour, a conversation with Noam Chomsky, for close to 40 years, one of the most outspoken critics of American foreign policy. And our question for you, Connection listeners: where do you stand on a U.S.-led war with Iraq? What is the case for and against? And do the protests, or can the protests, make a difference? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As I mentioned, my guest this hour is Noam Chomsky. He's the MIT professor of linguistics, known around the world for his prolific writing and speaking and criticism of American foreign policy. First, though, a check-in on the weekend of protest. And for that, we turn to Eli Presser. He's director of international campaigns for MoveOn.org. Hi, Eli.
Hi.
Tell me how you measure the importance of the long weekend of protests at this time.
Well, I think it's extremely important. And perhaps what's most important about it is that while we saw literally hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Our organization works with a group of 700,000 Americans who are, some of whom, you know, went to the protests on Saturday and Sunday, and some of whom didn't. But they're all very, very concerned about this war. And
you get your numbers electronically, Eli, by people who sign up on the web and then leave you with an email address?
Yeah, folks come into our list, they sign a petition, or they make a phone call or something like that, and they say, I want to be a part of this. And then we keep them informed on all of the kind of latest doings.
Who are these people, Eli?
Well, it's hard to say, because they're, you know, with 700,000 folks, you have just about one of everything. You have multiple of everything. But they tend to be people who are not, they wouldn't consider themselves activists. They're not, some of them haven't been politically active ever before. And they're joining up and signing up and getting involved because they've never felt this worried before about the potential consequences for this country and for the world if we go to war. And so, you know, they're ordinary, mainstream, patriotic folks who feel like now's the time that they have to speak up.
Noam Chomsky, tell me how you're watching the protests now and how you measure them at this time.
Well, the most striking thing about them, I think, is, first of all, that they're worldwide. There's never been a case in history that I can think of where there was such overwhelming worldwide opposition to a military action that's being undertaken. Furthermore, in the United States or in Europe, there simply is no historical precedent for anything like this kind of opposition to a war at a comparable stage. Remember, this war hasn't even begun yet.
That's why I was asking you this. You have some experience here. Do you think that means something at this point?
Well, certainly, if history means something, yes, it means something. There literally is no precedent. So, for example, in the case of the Vietnam War, there was substantial protest, but that was 6 or 7 years after the war had begun. The U.S. actually publicly announced the attack on South Vietnam 40 years ago, 1962. That's when a public announcement was made that the U.S. Air Force is bombing South Vietnam, that ultimately millions of people were being driven into what amounted to concentration camps. Chemical warfare was initiated to destroy crops. There was no protest. It wasn't even a hint of protest. It wasn't until 4 or 5 years later that protest began to reach a substantial scale. By that time, South Vietnam, which was always the primary target of the U.S. attack, had been devastated. There were saturation bombings going on in densely populated areas and so on. And even then, the protest was mostly about the attack on North Vietnam.
Let me just go back to Eli in terms of the protest and the people that you're hearing from electronically. Do you have any reason to believe that the people who are checking in on the website are doing it and participating because they believe they can make a difference, Eli?
Yeah, I think, you know, the another difference between this movement and some of the other anti-war movements that we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years is that we have all sorts of policy experts, security professionals, you know, the security elite. Many of those people are on our side as well, and so there's this feeling, I think, that with as many members of Congress as we have, as many members of, you know, many people who really know their stuff, that this isn't a marginal concern. This is something that comes from sort of mainstream America, and that because of that, we actually stand a chance of budging the administration.
Eli, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Eli Presser is in charge of international affairs for the organization MoveOn.org. And Noam Chomsky, I've watched your writing in the pages of The Nation and across the internet on this for a lot longer than people have been marching in the streets in the way that Eli is describing from the weekend of protests. Do you see two types of protests that go on as a matter of course, that there is the intellectual argument, the one involving sort of political academics like yourself, and then the folks who will you know, pick up a sign and go to Washington? Or do you see them as crossing over, coming together?
Oh, they're interacting. And in fact, what Eli just said is quite striking. The mainstream establishment security elite that he was talking about, mm-hmm. they did turn against the Vietnam War by about 1968 or 69. And then you had them, you know, going to Washington and criticizing Kissinger and so on. Now it is just remarkable. I mean, the two major foreign policy journals, Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy, this month both have articles condemning the war pretty harshly. The American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which almost never takes positions on controversial issues, has just published a long monograph on the war, rather critical. This is across the board. This is before it begins.
Let's talk about what's in the news today. There's a report from the BBC in Britain that Tony Blair, testifying before a parliamentary committee there, is saying that Iraq is rattled. They're weakening, Britain's getting a massive amount of intelligence as to what's happening in Iraq. The headline on the story, Saddam regime crumbling. We see from New York, the French foreign minister digging in his heels on going back to the UN Security Council, saying that even if the Security Council meets again, France will say, no, the weapons inspection is working. Do you draw a link between those kinds of reports and the measure of protest that we've been watching?
Well, Tony Blair is almost unique among world leaders in supporting Bush's war. The opposition internationally, again, is completely without protest. It gets stronger when you get closer to the region. So, say, take Turkey, the major U.S. ally.
You were there just a week or so ago, weren't you?
I was just there, in fact. But the latest poll results from there indicate something like 90% opposition to the war. I just can't find. In fact, the Erdogan, basically the head of the governing party, just yesterday made another strong statement opposing the war. The U.S. is trying to compel them to overrule the will of the overwhelming majority of the population and to participate in the war, and the U.S. has weapons which may force them to do that, financial and other weapons. But the commitment of the U.S. government to override any kind of democratic process is very striking.
What if Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush are right? What if the measure of the troops being sent to the Persian Gulf, the daily reports in newspapers around the world about the buildup, Blair saying 26,000 soldiers heading to the Gulf as of yesterday, is in fact exactly what is required to intimidate Saddam Hussein to the point where he says, I'm not going to have another confrontation. I will go into exile, or you know, dissidents in Iraq will say, we don't want this, we're going to overthrow Saddam Hussein. What if just the buildup of force is precisely what's required to remove this guy, which, and I mean, you're among those who calls him a monster.
Oh, of course, I've been saying that ever since Rumsfeld was supporting him back in the 1980s, right through his worst atrocities. Yeah, he's a monster. We should get rid of him. The huge buildup is not there in order to intimidate him. It's there in order to start a war. That's quite different. Certainly measures should be taken, any sensible measures, to help those who want to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
Inside the country, assisting Iraqis, not using outside.
And in fact, if we turn to people who know something about Iraq, and unfortunately are pretty well cut out of discussion here, what they've been, for the most significant of them, are the heads, former and present heads of the UN humanitarian mission, so-called Oil for Peace mission. These are people who have, these are distinguished UN diplomats with years of experience, highly respected. They have hundreds of inspectors who've been traveling around the country constantly. They surely know more about Iraq than any Westerner, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, and now their successor. Who have been pointing out, I mean, both of them resigned because they regarded the sanctions as, in their words, genocidal. They say they've been destroying the civil society, strengthening Saddam Hussein. And if the civil society could reconstruct, Saddam Hussein might be easily overthrown from within. That's happened with many other monsters and dictators. I mean, nobody would have predicted that Ceausescu would have been overthrown, or Suharto, or that apartheid would have been overthrown. I mean, these things happen when there's a live, functioning civil internal society, which we have destroyed through the sanctions. And any measures that could be taken to support an Iraqi overthrow of Saddam Hussein would be very welcome.
And sending American troops to the Gulf is not part of that.
Sending that American troops to the Gulf, for all we don't really know, but it very likely strengthens him, just as the sanctions have.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Noam Chomsky is my guest. We're talking about the changing events, both in New York, in France, in Britain, in Iraq, as we look at the what may be a build-up to war, or what may be a building in the peace movement, which perhaps could change that. We're interested in your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For the latest on the attack that killed one American civilian and wounded another in Kuwait.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Noam Chomsky. Our subject, war and Iraq. We're interested in hearing from you at 1-800-423-8255. Noam, next week, Monday, report from the weapons inspectors. Tuesday, State of the Union address from Bush. Wednesday, the UN begins debate on the report. Is it as pivotal a week as it appears?
It's a very pivotal week. The question is whether the U.S. government will pay some attention to what it knows perfectly well is overwhelming popular and even governmental opposition to the plans that it is undertaking. I mean, in this respect, Turkey is a rather striking example. Turkey is a NATO ally. It's the major U.S. base in the region. That's where the U.S. has major military bases there with bombers flying over Iraq and so on, Incirlik and so on. Approximate, according to the London Economist, the latest polls show 90% opposition to the war. Now, the question is that going to matter to the U.S. government?
Does it
matter that 90% of the population in the country that's closest by and is the closest U.S. ally think that this is an outrageous and horrible event? That tells us that will tell us something. The answer to that question will tell us something about the concern of the Bush administration for something as simple as democracy. Are they going to pay attention? And this is not alone. This is all through Europe. It's right through the region. There isn't outside of Israel, which has its own interests. There's no regional power that supports the war. In fact, you have to go very far to find any support. Even in England, Blair is pretty isolated, even in his own party. In fact, even in the United States, see, if you take a look at polls in the United States, they seem to indicate, I stress seem, higher support for a war than you find anywhere else.
Like 88%, according to
some. Well, that's not quite accurate.
All
right. 88% if there is international support and a Security Council. Yeah. But even those figures, whatever they are quite misleading because the people who are taking the polls don't ask the necessary next question, namely, why are you in favor of it? And as soon as you ask that question, you notice something that distinguishes the United States from the rest of the world. It's hard to miss the fact that although Saddam Hussein is hated and reviled everywhere, he's feared only in the United States. It's only in the United States that people fear that unless we stop him today, he's going to kill us tomorrow.
He's feared in Iraq as well.
In Iraq, but that's of no concern to U.S. planners. We know perfectly well how they act. The same people acted when he was carrying out his worst atrocities. They supported him. So that's not their concern.
Okay, but if I follow that through...
But now the question we ought to ask is, why is the United States so different from the rest of the world in that it actually fears that he's going to attack us? Well, you know, that's since September. There has been a drumbeat of propaganda in the United States since September trying to convince people that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to our existence. There's going to be a mushroom cloud over New York. Why aren't they afraid in Turkey or in Kuwait or Iran or other places? Why or Europe? Why only the United States?
Okay, well, you've banged heads with the people in Washington often enough. Look at their list of reasons why Iraq needs, why this attack needs to take place.
They don't give a single reason why Iraq
but
is
the reasons
a threat
that they
to,
give haven't changed. Protecting the U.S. from weapons of mass destruction, combating terrorism, promoting democracy. I mean, no amount of protest or in Turkey or France has said anything which would push them off.
Oh, on the contrary. It is only in the United States that there is concern that he might attack us, which is a contingency so remote that no one else in the world even pays attention to it. This is a special fact about U.S. propaganda and its effect inside the United States since September. September happens to be when the campaign began. It's also, not coincidentally, the moment when the midterm congressional election campaign began. And it was, in fact, specifically, clearly directed to the election, and it succeeded. It succeeded in suppressing people's primary interests in socioeconomic issues and making them huddle under the umbrella of power. Now, going back to the polls, if we extract that difference between the United States and other countries, I think we'd find that opposition to the war here is approximately like everywhere else.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Norfolk, Virginia, and Joe's calling in. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a minister, and I have definite pacifist tendencies, but I am torn because I do have this fear that a nuclear weapon or another weapon of mass destruction might make it through our porous borders and be detonated. And so I wonder, given that fact, if war with Iraq isn't something that's necessary?
Well, I think your fears are very appropriate. It's been pointed out by the CIA, foreign intelligence agencies, plenty of analysts here. You can read the current foreign policy journals, that the way to maximize the fear that you're concerned about is to attack Iraq. There's no, you know, neither the CIA nor anyone else has suggested that there's any likelihood of Iraq attacking the United States with weapons of mass destruction. That would be a recipe for instant incineration. However, they have pointed out, and it's pretty plausible, that if the United States does attack Iraq, it's possible that they may set off some actions, either of revenge or deterrence, and the only ones really available to them are just the kinds of things you described, maybe not a nuclear weapon, but some terrorist act that may already be in place and is likely to be used if there is an attack on Iraq. You can actually read that in the CIA report that was leaked, presented to Congress last October. But it's pretty obvious. I mean, analysts have been pointing that out all along. What they've been pointing out is that in order, the argument that you're giving, and that comes from the administration, is that in order to deter a very low probability potential attack, we are going to carry out an action which raises the probability of such an attack to a rather high level.
There's a piece of the puzzle, though, that's missing, which I think is part of Joe's concern. I know I've heard it before on this program, and that is that the U.S. claims to know a great deal more about what weapons are, in fact, being hoarded away in Iraq, that this information hasn't even been given to the weapons inspectors, the explanation being that if that information was out, the weapons would be moved. But what I mean, isn't that in large part where the fear comes from, that sense that there's a great deal of intelligence information out there that nobody's privy to except the people in
notice,
the Pentagon?
Notice, first of all, they've claimed that, and there isn't the slightest reason to believe it. Whenever they've presented any information, it's proven to be inaccurate. Furthermore, if they had such information, they would precisely be giving it to the weapons inspectors secretly, not so the weapons would be moved, secretly, so they could then go precisely to the places where those weapons are. The fact that they're not giving the information suggests something, namely they don't have it. But even if they had it, let's say they had it. I mean, suppose that Saddam Hussein is burying nuclear weapons somewhere and nobody's been able to find them. That's not the concern that the caller raised. He raised a serious concern. That is not a serious concern. I mean, even if, you know, it's hopelessly unlikely, but let's imagine that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons. How he wouldn't use them against the United States or against anyone. If he even made a minimal threat to use them, Iraq would be obliterated.
Joe, back to you.
No, but the question that he did raise is important. What about terrorist acts in the United States or in other countries, which may already be in place? That has nothing to do with nuclear weapons in Iraq. That has to do with the kind of terrorism that is feared. And that is precisely what is likely to be elicited by an attack on Iraq, not
Joe,
otherwise.
Joe, terrorism in the United States as a result of an attack rather than in advance of.
It's scary, and the issue is just really complicated. And I've been trying to, I guess, wrap my mind around it and figure out what's best, but it's very difficult these days.
Mm-hmm. I think the logic is quite clear, and the CIA and other analysts are quite explicit about this, again, both foreign affairs journals this month. If Iraq is, as the CIA pointed out, if Iraq, although they find no probability of a very low likelihood of anything now, if Iraq is attacked, if Saddam Hussein's back is to the wall, if they have no other choice, yeah, chances are they'll pull out all the stops.
So, Joe, who do you listen to? Where are you getting your information?
From here, from network news, from cable news, just about everywhere that I can find it.
Well, I'd really advise you to read the CIA letter to the Senate Intelligence Committee that was, I think, published in the New York Times, I believe, on October 9th, where they just repeat what everybody knows, that the chances of an Iraqi attack anywhere now are extremely low, but they become quite high if Iraq is under attack and if Saddam Hussein's back is against the wall and he's desperate.
Joe, thanks for your call. Let's go to Revere, Massachusetts. Ian's joining us. Hi, Ian.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question for Professor Chomsky, which goes as follows. Now, and let me preface this by saying that I am a leftish. I am a dove or possibly farther to the left. But anyway, that said, my question goes as follows. Now, I'd like to get a more comprehensive and perhaps comprehensible view of Professor Chomsky's foreign policy beliefs. Now, I'm going to go back to a recent conflict.
Well, we've only got a one-hour show here. I need a more specific question than
okay,
that.
Okay, here we go. All right. I'm curious to know why Professor Chomsky came out so strongly against the U.S. involvement in the Kosovo and also in Bosnia, whereas I see that as one of the few legitimate uses of American military power since World War II.
Actually, I said virtually nothing about Bosnia. I was more or less supportive of the final actions that were taken. I thought that earlier steps should have been taken in the early 90s to prevent the atrocities that later took place. But you didn't read anything of mine about that. You may have read secondary reports of it because I didn't write anything about it.
There was a publication called Masters of the Universe, and it was a critique, a strong critique, of U.S. involvement, military involvement in Kosovo.
You talked about Bosnia.
Let's stick to Kosovo.
Story. In the case of Kosovo, what I wrote is that the question of whether the U.S. should bomb Kosovo is unanswered. I left it basically unanswered. I said I thought there were diplomatic options that could have been pursued, and I think there's pretty strong evidence for that in retrospect. But I said almost nothing about it. I talked about a different issue, namely, what were the motives for the bombing of Kosovo? The claim was that the bombing of Kosovo was undertaken in order to put an end to ethnic cleansing. And as I pointed out, that is simply false. There is an extensive, rich record of Western documentation from the State Department, from NATO, from the OSCE, from the international observers. And what it points out explicitly is that the ethnic cleansing was a consequence of the bombing, not a cause. In fact, we now have Wesley Clark, the general's memoirs, in which he explains that he pointed out to Washington a month before the bombing that if the bombing was undertaken, there would be atrocities and ethnic cleansing, and NATO would be doing nothing to be able to stop them. Well, I went through that whole record, and I went through the record of the positions, the diplomatic positions that were taken by the U.S. and by Serbia on the eve of the bombing, and pointed out further that after 78 days of bombing, a peace agreement was reached, which was a compromise between the two. And I said that raised serious questions about the bombing, and I think it does. But that's about all I said about it.
But if we look back to that time, there were a lot of people who listened to what you said about Kosovo and said, Chomsky's gone too far on this one.
Too far by reviewing in detail the documentation that was being given by Western sources about what was happening. No, I don't think so.
I think that the question, if I recall at the time, and I'm not going to go back into a bunch of documents that I don't have in front of me. You've got a better recall of them than I do. But is there ever a time when this type of force, be it NATO-led, be it UN-led, be it American-led, can work on behalf of human rights
In principle, it's certainly possible. In fact, you can think of cases where it might have been useful. The question was here, given what we know, and what we know is from overwhelmingly massive Western documentation, was it appropriate in that case? Was it appropriate to carry out bombing with the expectation that it would lead to massive atrocities and ethnic cleansing, conscious expectation, when in fact there were diplomatic options on the table and the ultimate result was a compromise between them? That was the question. I actually took no strong position on the answer to the question, but I did go through that evidence. And I think that, in retrospect, we should rethink that. And I'd say the same about other cases. We should look carefully at the evidence. Look, the use of force, you never have to have an argument against the use of force, whether it's domestic affair, you know, interpersonal affairs or international affairs. You need an argument for the use of force. And it has to be a very strong argument, always. Again, whether it's domestic abuse or international relations, you need a very strong, there's a heavy burden of proof to bear when you call for violence. I'm not a pacifist. I think that sometimes that burden can be met, and I've given cases, but it is a very heavy burden. In the case of Kosovo, in my opinion, it wasn't met for the reasons I just mentioned and have reviewed in detail. In this case, I think there is, it hadn't even come close to being met. But yes, there are cases. So, for example, I supported U.S. actions after the U.S. was attacked in World War II. And there are other cases where I think it's possible. However, if we're really interested in reducing the level of violence and terror in the world, there are many things we can do short of the use of violence. The major one is to stop participating in it. It's kind of interesting that that's never discussed. So, for example, I did just return from Turkey, where some of the worst atrocities of the 1990s took place, much worse than anything attributed to Milosevic in Kosovo before the NATO bombing. And that was carried out with overwhelming U.S. support. Millions of people driven out of the devastated countryside, tens of thousands killed. Just a couple of weeks ago, I visited refugees living in miserable slums who can't go back to the destroyed countryside. That's a way to stop atrocities, and you can run through many such examples.
My guest is Noam Chomsky. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we want to hear from you, your feeling, your sense about the American-British buildup in the Gulf, the inevitability of war. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Noam Chomsky's in the studio with me, and we're talking about the growth in the peace movement, the speeding up of the mobilization for war in Iraq, and where we are at this moment. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Alan's joining us. Hi, Alan.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. First of all, I just wanted to make a statement. Number one, I think we need to support our president. I think he knows, you know, the details better than most people. I think he has a lot of people around him that can tell him, you know, what is going on and what needs to be done. Number two is we definitely need to support our troops. Number three, we don't need another Vietnam where we have a split country where, you know, they come back and you know, they're getting a bunch of hassle and everything else. You know, we need to support our troops. We need to let them know that we're behind them. And I'm not for war either. Nobody's for war. But if we have to, the job needs to be done. Now, I'm hoping that it will scare Saddam into making some changes enough to where we don't have to go to war. Maybe he will see that we're serious, and before that happens, he'll stop. But if he doesn't, I feel we have to make a change, and if we have to do it, we do. And he said, the other guy said something about the fact that don't need to worry about them attacking us, but we've already been attacked once. And why not do something about it when we can, instead of saying, afterwards, oh, gosh, I can't believe that just happened. We need to get serious. We need to protect our country. And even if nobody else agrees with us, we have to do what we have to do to protect our country.
Alan, I'm just going to ask you to hang on a second and let Noam Chomsky talk back to you here.
Well, I agree with you, certainly, that we should support our troops, and I think the best way to support them is to bring them right back home so they won't go into a war that nobody wants and doesn't make any sense. As for just following the orders of the president, I don't agree with you. That's what's done in totalitarian states, not in democratic societies. In democratic societies, you evaluate for yourself whether the leadership is making the right decisions or not. You don't just follow them blindly. As to defending ourselves from being attacked, I completely agree with that. And therefore, I also agree with U.S. intelligence agencies, foreign policy analysts, and others who point out the obvious. We were not attacked by Saddam Hussein. There is no known connection, and very unlikely to be a connection, between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. They're all monsters, but they're totally different kinds of monsters, and they hate each other. The best, if we want to raise the probability of an attack on the United States, the best way to do it is to invade Iraq. That has been pointed out over and over again, even by the CIA. Yes, it's very likely that if we, it's not very likely, but it's possible that if we attack Iraq, Saddam Hussein will use the only weapon available to him, namely attacks in the United States. Otherwise, there's no probability that. So sure, we should defend the United States by being sensible. You don't defend the United States by increasing the probability of an attack on the United States. Let me make another point. An attack on Iraq, even under the most optimistic scenario of Donald Rumsfeld, you know, over instantly, no fighting, everything's wonderful, it's still almost inevitably going to spawn a new generation of terrorists bent on revenge, looking for deterrence, realizing that the only way to deter an American attack is either by developing weapons of mass destruction or by carrying out terror, and that will seriously increase the insecurity of the United States. So, yes, we should be definitely worried about defending ourselves, but we should do it sensibly.
Alan?
Yes.
What do you think?
I see what he's saying, but at the same time, you know, it seems to me that we're going to act like a little scaredy cat because of the fact that we're not going to do, because maybe more terrorists will come about. Well, I'm sorry, but we need to be an American country. We need to be a strong country. And that's just a liberal view that, and he must, I just feel like he's definitely a liberal because, you know, we need to stand up for this country. We don't need to keep sitting down and whining and being little scaredy cats. We got to go in there and kick butt and get it done.
Even if it increases the danger to us.
Alan, even if it increases the danger to the United States? I think we've lost to Alan there,
okay.
But I think also that
yeah.
You made your point. 1-800-423-8255. Durham, North Carolina. Jane is joining us. Hi, Jane.
Good morning. My question is very specific. I have not heard it answered anywhere. And that is exactly what do we do about Saddam's flagrant throwing off of the regulations and sanctions set down by the Security Council at the UN, the international community? How do you address what he is doing to just throw that out? And what is the precedent that is set by that?
The way in which you deal with his violations of the Security Council resolutions is exactly what is being done, namely enforce them by having inspectors carry out the most intensive, by far the most intensive investigations that have ever been carried out to try to overcome those violations. And in fact, we should generalize that. Saddam Hussein is not the only, he's a monster, but it's not the only place in the world where Security Council resolutions are violated. There's been a good deal of discussion, not so much in the United States, but everywhere else in the world, over the fact that the leading U.S. ally also happens to be the leading violator of U.N. Security Council resolutions, namely Israel. So those should be enforced. But all of this discussion is missing. Here is a point that no one has discussed, and it's extremely significant. Just ask yourself, how many UN resolutions would Saddam Hussein have violated if he had the veto power? Well, the answer to that is none. If he had a veto, he would have violated no resolutions. So therefore, if we're serious about violating Security Council resolutions and about rendering the UN irrelevant, the first thing we should look at is the veto. That's the way to violate Security Council resolutions, veto them. Well, if we look at the veto, we make an interesting discovery. Since the 1960s, after decolonization set in, the U.S. UN was no longer under control, the leading, far in the lead in vetoing resolutions is the United States. Second is Britain. No one else is even close. That means the most massive violation of Security Council resolutions happens to be right here, Britain next. And remember, if Saddam Hussein had that capacity, he wouldn't violate any resolutions. The veto is the main method for violating Security Council resolutions. And that has not been discussed at all, and that's outrageous. It's the major topic.
But to follow that along, you bring Saddam Hussein in and give him a veto, and that's not going to change anything.
Oh, gosh, I'm not calling for that. I'm just saying that if we're serious about the question of violating Security Council resolutions, we should, first of all, look at the major way of violating them, namely by vetoing them.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Jane, thank you for that. To where are we going now? To Raleigh, North Carolina, and Leonard's joining us. Hi, Leonard.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a former soldier from, you know, did my 20 years and everything in the military. And as far as war comes up to the point, you know, I think we better not support our president. We better start supporting the facts. And as the question was arise about supporting the troops, are you willing to support, is America designed to support our troops coming back mangled, Gulf War syndrome, and the United States government don't want to notarize that as an illness? So you got a lot of soldiers walking around here. They can't get the benefits, can't get the treatment that is required for them. Is that how you support our soldiers? We need to look at Saddam Hussein as a serious threat. And ground war is definitely something we don't want to deal with him on because he has chemical agents, he has nuclear biological agents, possibly. We haven't proven that. But what facts has the government given us? If you're so ready to go to war, where is the facts? Put it out in the open because you're asking a lot of soldiers to go out there, put their life on the line, and then what? We don't complete the war?
So you're saying bring everybody home, or you're saying that the president... Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, bring everybody home because we've started two wars, Osama bin Laden, and where is he at? We haven't even found him. Do we have facts that war was even completed? We don't want America to be attacked, and attacking is one way we're going to get demolished here because we don't know where the little cells are, where all the little hate people are against America. We're not a well-liked country. So, you know, why are we so eager to go to war? Have we did everything possibly to talk this thing out? Have we sent the right people to do the talking? Because it's all about the image. If you send President Bush over there, well, you know he doesn't have a personality-type person. So, personality. So...
Okay, Leonard, let me see if I can bring Noam Chomsky.
Well, I agree with everything you said. I think the way to support the troops is to keep them out of danger. Yes, it's perfectly if I had to guess, I would say probably Saddam Hussein does have chemical and biological weapons, a fair probability. And if he has them and he's on the verge of being destroyed and killed, he'll probably use them against American soldiers, maybe in the United States. So, yes, you're quite right. All of this, and I think you're right that no serious reasons have been given for this. And remember, before you use violence, you need very serious reasons. That should lead us to ask what the real reasons are, since it's almost certain that they're not the ones that are being proposed.
Let me ask you, if I can, when you speak, as you have so often in this country and abroad about the people taking into account American misdeeds in the past, foreign affairs issues from Central America, from South America. You talk about these things a lot and use that to make the case that the United States is in many ways the leading terrorist power in the world. Fair enough?
Yes, I think that's true. And the point is that if we want to stop violence and terror, one way of doing it, however you think the U.S. ranks, I mean, I don't care where you rank,
right,
whatever it may be, one way to reduce violence and terror is to stop participating in it. That would already reduce the level of violence and terror very considerably. Now, let's just take the Middle East. I mean, it's perfectly true, as the last caller said, that the U.S. is very much, U.S. policy, not Americans. Americans are liked. U.S. policies are very much opposed in the Middle East. Why is this? Well, we can find the answers if we like. We can find the answers in the, this is a very free country, the United States. We have a lot of information about U.S. planning because we have access to it. You can go back to, say, the 1950s. When president from declassified
but
records.
Let's go back to September 11th, 2001.
Yes,
because
but that
everybody
begins,
uses that.
That begins earlier.
I know.
It didn't start on September 11th.
But what we're talking about is American public attitudes about a war today based on attitudes which were formed in large part on that day, September 11th, 2001.
In the United States, on September 11th, the right response is to ask the question why it happened and try to deal with the situation that made it happen and to alleviate that situation.
But so you do that from a very clinical, academic point of view, and I wonder
if
you...
It's not academic. I don't want to have other terrorist atrocities in the United States. And if you want to reduce terrorist atrocities, if you're even sane, the first thing you do is look at their causes. If you don't want to look at their causes, you'll just increase the atrocities. I mean, that's just elementary. There's nothing academic about it. I mean, that's for my grandchildren. I don't want them to be attacked. So therefore, I want to know the reasons why things like this happen. If we want to know the reasons why things like this happen, we're going to have to search the record. And there we will find the reasons. As I started to say, you can go back 40 years and find President Eisenhower talking about the campaign of hatred against us in the Middle East. And you'll find the National Security Council giving the reasons, namely the U.S. support. People in the region perceive the United States, rightly they say, as supporting oppressive, harsh governments which block democracy and development and doing it because we want control of their oil resources. You can find the same things when the Wall Street Journal does analyses of opinion there today. Yeah, we ought to pay attention to that.
Ask the questions, Connection listeners. There's a challenge for you from my guest, Noam Chomsky. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yep.
Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at MIT, longtime critic of U.S. foreign policy. We talked earlier in the program with Eli Perresser, director of international campaigns for MoveOn.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.